At Whole Foods Market, we review each and every product that hits our shelves. Our cleaning products are no exception. Our EcoScale ranking system rates each household cleaner so you know what you're getting. Now, during Earth Month and any time of the year, learn more at WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
I'm Grace Bonnie, and you're listening to After the Jump. We are coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You can listen to us every Monday at noon on heritageradionetwork.org, and you can also download the podcast at iTunes. Today, I am very, very happy to have with me Megan Allman, who is a designer, a metalsmith, an educator, and who lives by a website statement that I'm very much in love with, which is make a statement every day. And whenever I load your website, that makes me really happy because you're about to make a very big statement. You're here to talk about a book that you're working on called In Defense of Stuff, which I'm very excited to talk about. So thanks for coming up to New York to talk with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Grace. I'm so excited to be on the show and to kind of talk about some of these ideas that I've been living with for a while now.
So before we get into the book idea, I want to kind of back up and I want to read the manifesto. So you're working on something called In Defense of Stuff, and you've got a website called StuffDoesMatter.com. And basically you're going to be talking about people sort of mixed emotions with the idea of stuff and objects and owning things. And as a design blogger and with you as a maker, that's something I think we both struggle with a lot.
Yeah.
So I want to start by reading the manifesto on your website because I think it's wonderful and it kind of sums up where we're going to go with the conversation today. So this is the manifesto from Megan's website. It's StuffDoesMatter.com. Stuff does matter. Stuff has a place in our world and in your life. Objects matter beyond their utility. Caring about things is not wrong. Your stuff helps you make sense of the world. Stuff connects you to people, to your past, present, and future. Stuff provides meaning, beauty, and experience. Stuff helps you remember and share. There's a difference between mindless consumption and the way you feel. Savor what you have, buy only what you love. Allow your things to enrich your life, and choose gratitude over guilt. Know that the things you love do matter. That's a really good manifesto, Megan.
Thank you. I had a little help. But
So tell us about how this idea came about, because before we started recording, you were talking about this is something that's sort of been brewing for a long time.
Yeah, so this is something that's been brewing for a long time. I have been an artist and a maker pretty much my entire life. I started taking drawing classes outside of school probably when I was 5 or 6. Growing up, I always thought I was going to be an architect or a painter or something, and I ended up going to college for metalsmithing and jewelry. And so that's what I went to undergrad for and grad for. And I actually did an undergrad thesis on sensory jewelry. I did a master's thesis on domesticity and floral pattern textiles. So I've been thinking about these kind of ideas my whole life. But everything sort of came to fruition for me in March. I had actually gone to Europe and gone to some of the museums that had always been on my, you know, my high list, the Victoria and Albert in London, the Louvre, all of those museums. But then while I was in London, my mother passed away. And so I went home and I started kind of thinking about things. And I started seeing all of this really negative criticism around stuff. So I saw things like, you know, the TV show Hoarders, and which is, you know, sort of the epitome of our unhealthy relationship with stuff, and even just talk about consumption and waste. And then I also started looking at the minimalist movement, this idea that stuff really doesn't matter and that we can just get rid of it all because it's not important. And what I realized is that I have spent my whole life really understanding just how important stuff is. It's part of how I experience the world. It's part of how I learn my family history. And I think that there's got to be a middle ground somewhere between hoarding and getting rid of it all. And I think somewhere in there is a healthy relationship with stuff trying to come out.
It'd be terrible if those are the only two options.
Right. It's
I'd probably go with hoarding. I feel like that's really where I lean towards, like a flattened cat under a couch.
That's where I would go to first, which is, I guess, is why I'm here defending stuff in the first place.
Exactly. So let's talk a little bit about stuff. I think for me, I have a very knee-jerk reaction to the word stuff. And I think a lot of people do. I used to have a friend who would say, like, God, I hate how much you say stuff on your website. And I kind of agreed with her. I think it's a word that has negative connotations. And if I think about a similar word, like if I was going to say the importance of objects or the importance of possessions, I feel like immediately people would say, oh, like, I get it. Objects are important. And they think of like a sculpture, or a beautiful vase or something. But I think the idea of stuff is much broader than that. So tell me what, to you, the difference between stuff and objects or possessions are.
Well, you know, it's funny because I was first talking about this idea with my husband, and he we were out at dinner and he was kind of zoning out. And I was like, what's wrong? And he goes, I hate that you use the word stuff. It just means like crap to me. So I started having conversations with people, and I actually started out by talking about the idea as an idea about objects. And what I realized was people who use the word objects is a very small subset of people. It's art historians. It's designers. It's not the way that most people in the world talk about the things around them. And what I realized is all the conversations that were negative were using the word stuff as a derogatory term. And I don't think that it has to be a derogatory term. So in a way, even though it's a little challenging to use the word because I think people immediately jump to the negative connotations, for me, it actually is about trying to flip the way that we think about it. And so when I don't really see a difference between the word stuff and the word objects, because I think that really it's all about this sort of collective thing. And what I want to do is take that word stuff and help people see how it's not just about a mass. It actually is about individual things.
So one of the things I think that will let people understand this concept a little better is talking about the difference between like good stuff and bad stuff. What is that to you? Or is there really a definition, or is it different for everybody?
I think it's different for everybody. One of the things that I'm realizing is that everybody's relationship to stuff is very different. So first, just on a really basic level, we all have different needs of amounts of stuff. I call it our stuff metabolism. Some people, you know, you're saying that you tend more towards hoarding. And I think some people just want to be surrounded by a lot of objects. For me, if I'm in a room that doesn't have a ton of books, and I think about books as objects, not just words. If I'm in a space that doesn't have a lot of that, I kind of feel a little like, what's going on? Too much empty space. Whereas some people might need that kind of cleaner, more minimalist space where they just want a few things. And so I think that that varies from person to person. But then the way that we relate to individual objects varies from person to person. So some people might really be drawn to objects because of memory. And I think a good example of this is our relationship with photography. And I know that photography now exists in a digital world, but we grew up in a world where photography was in fact a physical object. And so some people might have a lot of photographs in their home because it reminds them of something. They have this sense of memory and their friends and events. You know, my sister, it's just all pictures of like her and her friends hanging out at parties. Whereas for me, you know, I look at photographs as an aesthetic experience and I want the beautiful thing, and it's not always the person. Sometimes it is, but it might not be. And so here is the case where we both value photography, but we do it for very different reasons. And so I think that's part of the challenge when you're looking at stuff, is that we all have deeply personal and different relationships to the things around us. And so it's really hard to pick and defend one reason why stuff matters.
Well, I think it's really hard to sort of balance that out, because you're saying like pick and defend. And I think there are ways you could probably defend everything in your house.
Yeah.
If you really wanted to. How do you think, or what are some good steps for people to sort of start with, to sort of realize what their connection to an object is and whether or not they should own it?
You know, I think the first thing is just to pay attention. You know, one of our problems and one of the reasons that we have this unhealthy relationship with stuff is because we actually don't take the time to enjoy and experience the stuff that we have. So if it's taking a minute to notice which things maybe your hand lingers on a little more, or, you know, which things get you really excited, starting to just pay attention is, I think, the first step. And I definitely don't have all the answers in terms of what that healthy relationship looks like yet. I'm still kind of working that one out for myself. But what I'm noticing is that as I pay attention to the things that I'm drawn towards, there's certain categories of things that do seem to make me happier and make a difference in my day. You know, I love that experience in the morning of holding my handmade mug while I drink my tea. Like, that's really important to me, but I had to take the time to notice that and recognize that.
I think sometimes you have to get to a point where you have too much stuff, and then you realize, like, why did I get here? How did I get here? And how do I back it up? Because I think as a blogger, I'm always trying to preach the message of, like, really slow down and, like, invest in things that are original, that are handmade, that you're going to actually have a story or a memory behind. And it does make a really big difference. I had that exact same mug experience with a friend who finally bought me a really beautiful Molly Hatch mug. And it was way too much money. And I think I had, like, mentioned that I wanted it, and she very sweetly saved up and got it for me. And that one mug means so much to me, not only because it was a gift, but because I knew the story behind it than like every fancy mug at whatever other store I could have bought. And I literally have three mugs in my life, and just that one mug is all I need, because it means so much to me.
Well, and I think that gets back to sort of the whole of what I want to do with this idea of stuff does matter, is that because we as a society don't value our stuff enough, we don't have those deep connections with anything. If you don't think about the people that are making it, the way it gets to you, if all you do is think, oh, stuff doesn't matter and it's disposable and I can bring in whatever, then you're going to go to Target and you're going to buy the cheap plastic cup, and you're not going to have that sense of connection or experience that you get when you realize that, you know what, if I do have a really beautiful mug, that can actually improve my morning and make a difference in my day. And then you're going to start to seek out that really good stuff.
I mean, do you think your position in life as a maker of jewelry and as a maker of many different things really is influencing this whole conversation? Because I rarely meet people who aren't involved in the arts in some way who are really deeply thinking about like how things are made, how they affect their daily life. And I think that probably plays a big role in it.
Yeah, I definitely think it has something to do with being a maker, even more so than being an artist. My husband is not an artist at all, but I would say he is also a person who really deeply values his relationships with stuff. Him and his friends build Jeeps. And so they have this great relationship with their tools and you know, driving the Jeep. And it's a whole topic of conversation, a whole community that they've built around this basically love for a very particular category of object. But I think that as a culture, most people don't grow up in that atmosphere anymore. If you didn't grow up in the arts, or if you didn't grow up, my husband, you know, hung out in wood shop and metal shop and all of those shop classes in high school. If you don't grow up in that kind of environment, then you aren't really taught to kind of notice and pay attention to the way things are made. And so I think that's more so than being an artist, it's part of the upbringing and being taught to, I guess, pay attention to stuff.
Absolutely. I feel like I grew up going to a Quaker school for the beginning couple years of my younger life. And I think just being informed at a younger age about building things, and like they gave us tools, probably way too young to have tools in our hands, that sort of thing made me pay attention to the stuff I had. And then I went back into public school and completely forgot everything. And then until I went back to college and was actually making things by hand again, I kind of forgot to pay attention to the things around me, because it just becomes part of this like, oh, you buy this because you have to. Like, I remember the college process of buying bedding and things for a dorm, and everybody bought a bed and a bag because that's what you buy. And I remember thinking, like, my mom had all these beautiful antique quilts, like maybe I should take one of those instead. But I got sucked into the like, this is the process of what you buy.
Yeah,
it's awful.
It is awful. And first of all, you're never too young to have tools. That's that might be my new life motto. But yeah, I think that people don't actually know that there is an alternative to the things that they are using. And so you get sucked into this process of, well, I need something new, so I'm going to go to Target and buy it. Or, you know, I need bedding for college, so I'm going to order off this form that people, you know, that the college sent to me. But I think it's really important that we take the time to show people, you know, there are alternatives. And, you know, it doesn't have to necessarily be handmade, but I think there needs to be this consciousness about what we are buying. And I kind of liken it to the kind of like holistic food movement. So when you know that food is really nourishing and good for you, you're not going to go and buy the crap. You're going to seek out the good stuff. And I think it's the same thing with our actual stuff. When you know that stuff can really have this great experience and improve your quality of life on a physical, on an emotional, on a mental level, you're going to go and seek out the stuff that's going to make you feel better.
Well, I think one of the things you've said already a lot that I like is there's like a middle ground. And I think that's what's going to make a message like this successful. Is you're not preaching like, get rid of everything you own, only keep the things that are handmade. Like, that's not realistic for most people, nor is it like their style. Some people are going to want, you know, for the sake of the extreme example, like plastic things from Target, which is completely fine.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with money or style or taste or anything. It's really about like working in those choices where they're appropriate for your life. And if you're a busy working mom, maybe sitting around and searching through Etsy for like handmade mugs all day is not something you have time for. And so the idea of going to Target, making a quick decision, if that allows more time for you to do other things that are more meaningful with your family, that's where it comes in.
Yeah. And for me, that, you know, I'm so glad you read the manifesto. The most important part for me is this idea of savor what you own, buy what you love. And that is a mandate that lets you decide what's most important to you and make those choices. So you're not buying things, or you're not owning things because you think that someone else tells you to, but because you're really deciding, you know what, this is meaningful and important to me. And so I'm going to enjoy the things that I have, and I'm going to seek out more of those things that I enjoy.
And I think it's something that people probably have to do on like a really regular basis. Every time I think I've like done a deep purge of my house, like 2 months later, I'm like, how did all this other stuff get in here? Like, secretly, there were elves that climbed into my room and like stuck extra magazines and boxes of stuff in my closet. And I think it's just something that's a part of natural life. And if you let go of the fact that you're just going to accumulate, and hopefully that every time you check in, there's a little bit less that you need to get rid of or donate or whatever, that's just kind of part of the process.
Well, and I think that's a really good point too, in that we need to understand that there's an ebb and flow of stuff in our lives, that just because we loved something once doesn't mean that we have to, you know, hold on to it forever. And I think people start to carry a lot of guilt about stuff. So we carry this guilt because we know that we live in a world where there is overconsumption and waste. And so you bring things in and then you feel guilty about getting rid of them, even though the relationship changes. There's this great book where the designer Jonathan Chapman talks about this idea that waste is a symptom of a failed relationship. And I love this concept, but instead of thinking about a failed relationship, I think we have to think about the fact that not all relationships last forever. There's a ebb and flow with everything. And so starting to realize that, you know what, I can bring things in because I love them at the moment, and then I can find responsible ways to pass them on to somebody else, means that you don't have to feel guilty about bringing stuff in and moving stuff out. You just kind of let that natural ebb and flow happen in your life.
Exactly. There's so much guilt associated with, like, the weight of objects, both like physical and mental. And I think that letting go of that guilt and accepting that things are going to change is a huge part of it. Last week we had on Meg Mateo Alaska, who's an amazing working mom and author and designer. And she was talking about sort of, you know, like, moms have to stop feeling guilty about not doing everything, because there is no, like, perfect, there's no perfect homeostasis, like, perfect balanced life. It's always about, like, a give and take. And I think the same thing exists with, like, your life. It's like whatever works until it doesn't anymore, and right. accept that you need something different, and that's totally okay.
Well, and if you let go of that guilt, then it gives you room to feel grateful for the stuff that you have. And that's what gives you the space to actually enjoy the things that you have, to really savor those objects, and then know that those are the objects that you do tend to build deeper relationships with and seek out more.
Well, I think that's also, I mean, one of the things in your manifesto was about accepting that objects will relate to or remind you of your past, present, and future. And mm-hmm. I think sometimes there's something really beautiful about looking at something that no longer speaks to you and sort of remembering that part of your life when it did, and then letting it go and accepting that you've grown, you've changed, you're a different person in some way. And that's a really powerful thing. And then you can let the object go. It doesn't have to hold that memory anymore.
Yeah. And I think that's such a good point, is that, you know, we also tend to classify objects only for certain purposes. Like, if it has a memory, I have to keep it. But if it's not something else, I don't have to keep it. And I think it's important to understand what triggers objects have for us. So, you know, for me, like, I wear my grandmother's wedding ring. And it's not because I need it to remember my grandmother. Obviously, I remember my grandmother. But when I had asked for the ring before I got married, because my grandmother had passed away a few years before, and when we got it out of kind of the jewelry box, I was the only woman in my family that the ring fit on her ring finger. Everyone else had rings that were, it was too small for them. And so as a metalsmith, I was like, oh, my long, skinny metalsmith fingers came from grandma. And that was really exciting. And so I wear my grandmother's ring, not necessarily because I need that memory, but because I need that sense of connection. And so that's important, too, is to know that, you know, memory is one reason to maybe keep things, but it's not the only reason that stuff matters.
Great. Well, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk a little bit about more reasons to sort of build memories with objects. Welcome back to After the Jump. I'm Grace Bonney, and today I am here with Megan Allman, who is the soon-to-be author of a book on the importance of stuff. And we've been talking about your manifesto and all the different ways people relate to objects, to why they're important to them, and then why it's important to let them go sometimes. So one of the things I want to talk about is what are some of your ideas for the actual plan of how you're going to change the way that people make different associations with objects? Do you think it's part of, like, a conversation that will initiate change, or are there actual steps you want people to do?
You know, I think it's both. So right now, for me, it's a lot about starting the conversation, because I think it's not a conversation that we're having. We're having these conversations in the extremes, as I mentioned before. You know, we're talking about the hoarding and the waste and the consumerism, all that stuff, or we're talking about just throw it all away. It doesn't matter. And so I think there has to be conversations in the middle that really say, you know what, let's look at how people relate to things. And what's interesting is, as I'm kind of talking about this idea with people, everyone has that story. You know, I told the story of my grandmother's ring. Everybody has a story like that. Everybody has something that they connect with in some way. And so I think that's part of it. But in the end, I would like to see, not necessarily steps, I don't really like that very prescriptive style, because I think it's different for everyone, but maybe guidelines for how people can sort of explore their relationship and come to terms with their own personal relationship with stuff, because it is very different for every person.
I think it's different. And I think there's this weird thing, and this could just be me completely projecting on your entire idea. But I think one of the things I struggle with is like, where do you draw the line when like you feel like you need more things? I have this thing where like a lot of people treat themselves with like food, or they treat themselves with like trips and things. And I, until very recently, really like treated myself with objects, and not big expensive things, but little things. And I would justify it as like, well, I had a bad day, or I had a bad week, and I really need this card or this tiny notebook or this weird little tiny ceramic bowl. And then I looked back and I had all these objects, and they didn't remind me of anything. They just kind of were stuff that I bought to make myself feel better. Do you think there's ever a time when it's okay for people to buy things because it makes them feel better?
Yeah, I actually do. I mean, I think it's important to understand if buying something because it makes you feel better is because the moment of buying something makes you feel better, or because the experience of the object is going to make you feel better. And I think that's the distinction. So if you're going out and you're like, I have to hear the cha-ching of the credit card and that's the trigger point, then I do think there's something that has to step back and evaluate. But if you're going, you know what, I'm having a crappy day and I'm going to buy this cute little notebook and I'm going to go home and I'm just going to doodle for 2 hours because that's what's going to make me feel better, I think that's perfectly legitimate. And then the notebook goes on the shelf, and later when you have another blue day, you pull it out, you sketch, or you look back through. So I think it's important to understand that objects can literally improve our mood if we let them, but it has to be the experience of the object and not necessarily the experience of, you know, paying the store clerk.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's something, I mean, as a sort of designer, lifestyle blogger, I constantly struggle with like this level of guilt of being like, I feel good about some of the things that we do, like business advice, and you've been a big part of the Biz Lady series as well. Like, but then on a day-to-day basis, I write about things. I write about a pillow, a scarf, a book, and those sorts of things. After a while, you start to feel like, am I just contributing to the idea of buying things? And it's a difficult feeling to struggle with.
Well, I think part of the problem is that we actually have this really big cultural stigma around visual culture and sensory culture and all of these things that you and I obviously both love because we're working on it. And so we have this sense of guilt because society tells us that we shouldn't be interested in these things because they're frivolous or they're shallow or things like that. But, you know, I read a really interesting story in a book actually called Stuff by Daniel Miller, who's an anthropologist. And he was doing field work in Trinidad. And what he was finding was, here are these women who were living in basically the slums of Trinidad, and they had 20 pairs of shoes. He was like, what's going on here? And so what he started to understand is that in the culture of Trinidad, this idea is that you wear your true self on the surface. And so if you hide things, if you keep things deep, as we think of deep as a good thing, they think of deep as a negative because that's someone who's deceitful and kind of lies. And so what Daniel Miller's point is not that one is right or wrong, but that they are both metaphors. And so this idea that the surface is shallow is just a metaphor in the same way that deep is actually meaningful, because really deep down we're just guts, you know, there's not a soul down there in the way that people think. So it's just a different way of looking at things. And for me, that was really freeing to be like, you know what, it doesn't actually mean that caring about aesthetics is unimportant. And I think that we've actually hit a point in our culture where we can see the product of pretending that beauty, that pretending that aesthetics is shallow, we can see where that's gotten us. And it's not a pretty picture, and it's not a healthy picture. I mean, drive down any suburban strip mall street in America and you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really difficult thing to shake off, because I think that over the last like decade in particular, the last 5 years, really in an intense way, things have soaked in a sense that it's hard to turn off that part of your brain that looks at it from like the outside in. And I think bloggers like me, we played a big part in that, and I have a hard time turning off that voice in myself that says like, oh, should I own this thing? Should I buy this thing? Because of the way it's going to look from the outside, is it, you know, it's really hard to turn that off. And I think that a culture where things are a big part of, like, it's just kind of seeped into us after a while.
Yeah. And, you know, I actually think that this kind of, this feeling that we have is not a new feeling. It's actually kind of a feeling that has developed through the history of modernity. And there's a book that I love called As Long as It's Pink, The Sexual Politics of Taste by Penny Spark, who is a design historian. And it's this fantastic book where she looks at the development of kind of domesticity in the Victorian era and then the denial of domesticity in the modernist era. And basically what she's saying is that this idea that what women in particular do in the home is has been kind of push to the feminine sphere. It wasn't always just the domain of women. And then it's been marginalized and trivialized. And so I think that it's important that we have these conversations about stuff to say, you know what, this is actually a really valid expression of culture. It's a really valid expression of taste. It's a really valid expression of creativity, that wanting to, you know, whether it's your person or yourself, wanting to construct that in a way that's meaningful to you is actually a very valid activity.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that's going to be increasingly important as time goes on, and as bloggers or any sort of online media goes on, is like showing a wider version of what that stuff is and what that expression is. I think one thing that always drives me crazy is you get this idea of aesthetic and owning things. And like we see this in like house tours on Design Sponge a lot. People assume that like a guy who likes things has like this very minimal house or this like very particular aesthetic. And that when women own things, it tends to be like much more cluttery. And I mean, you know, a less negative word than clutter. But there tends to be a lot more stuff happening.
Yeah.
And I think that's this weird association between masculine and feminine. And like we've started to sort of focus on people who are women who have much more minimalist houses. And someone always makes the comment of like, oh, it must be like the husband or the boyfriend who sort of influenced that style. And I always think, no, there really has to be a much more diverse sense of what ownership and what beauty and what objects mean to people, because I think that there's like a weird gender binary happening there as well with like what stuff looks like to people.
Yeah, I think there is. And I think too, it's like we have to embrace that there's room for every aesthetic and every style and every, I guess, volume of stuff, I want to say. Like, I think there's room for all of it. I am not one of those people who says, you know, you have to have this and it looks like that, and you have to have that and it looks like that. I think we all have different aesthetics that resonate with us for different reasons. I mean, you and I were talking about this a little bit before the show started. I actually happen to, on a design level, like a kind of minimalist aesthetic. You know, that's my website, all of those things. I like that aesthetic. But as a person, I've realized that I need objects around me because I need a serious kind of tactile and sensory experience. That's just part of the way that I relate to the world. And I know you guys can't see because it's radio, but I've been talking with my hands the whole time because that's how I experience things. I have to touch things. I have to hold things. I need that kind of tactile sensation around me. And that's okay because that's a big part of who I am and what sort of works for me. And so I think that's important, is figuring out what works for you.
Exactly. Well, I think it's funny sometimes to see that those opposites and those dualities exist in people you may not think. And like, I think most people who associate my site with me would think that I would have a house that's like super patterny and colorful. And I actually live in like a big empty box. It's very empty right now. And I love it because I need that contrast to how much visual stimulation happens in my work life. But I need that to happen in my work life. But it reminds me of a quotation that was on your website. You were recently at one of the Frank Lloyd Wright homes, Taliesin, and you had a quote from Frank Lloyd Wright, and he said, "Give me the luxuries of life and I will willingly do without the necessities." And I was really surprised to read that for some reason, because I think of him as such a minimalist, and the idea of him having like any luxury over necessity just didn't click with me. But I love seeing that people are sort of interested in those things over maybe the everyday.
Well, and I think that's the difference between minimalism as an aesthetic and minimalism as a lifestyle. So he did have this sort of minimalist aesthetic because he really wanted to take the homes and make them blend into the landscape, but he wasn't a minimalist in terms of his lifestyle. And so the example that the guide gave at Taliesin West is that they had 6 pianos on the property before they had running water.
Priorities.
Exactly. And I think that's an important part of understanding our relationship with stuff, is for him, having pianos was really, really important because it contributed to his quality of life. And that was more important than having running water. I don't know if some of the students studying at Taliesin thought the same thing, but it was Frank Lloyd Wright's project, so he got to call the shots. But I think to me that was something really beautiful and touching about him, is he understood what things meant the most to him in life. And those were the things that he surrounded himself with.
I mean, I think, again, it's coming back to like this idea of like a personalized version of this conversation for every human being, and then finding a way to make that balanced, and sort of some things are going to run a little crazy and some things are going to come back to a place that's a little bit more minimal. So how do you see this conversation progressing? I know you're working on getting the book made. What's kind of next for you for this conversation?
Yeah, I think next is starting to look at people's very individual experiences with things. I want to give people a chance to share their stories. And if they go to stuffdoesmatter.com and they click on the share your story link, they can go to our Facebook page and start to share their stories, because everyone does have those deep connections with stuff. And for me, that's what helps remind me that stuff does matter. It's not looking at the whole mass of what we have in the world. It's looking at people's really deep and intimate relationships with stuff. And then I also just think, for me personally, it's about kind of charting the path to figure out, you know, what stuff matters, what stuff, you know, can move on from the life. You know, I have a very personal journey that I'm going on of having to deal with, you know, my mother passing away a few months ago and figuring out what stuff of hers is worth keeping for me and for my siblings and for my dad, and what stuff we can let go of. And so, you know, that's something that I'm going to probably talk about more as I go through that journey, because it's a journey that a lot of us have. You know, we don't just have our own stuff. We have other people's stuff that comes into our lives. And for me, stuff is so tied up in family history that I want to get it right, that I really want to take the time. And I have that luxury of taking the time and figuring out which stuff is valuable, not because it mattered to my mother, but because it deepens that connection between my mother and myself, and hopefully highlights that connection when I have kids someday.
I think that's great. Well, thank you so much for sharing what's a very personal story. Thank you for sharing that with us. And I'm really excited to see where this goes. So thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, and thank you for having me. It was great to come on and share the story. So
we'll have you back anytime. And people, you can visit Megan. You can visit her at meganallman.com, and you can also visit her at stuffdoesmatter.com.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.